microbe. We're at 8,000 feet, perishing cold, and I'm bored stiff. What about putting on a hot gramophone record to cheer me up?
Hello? Hello? Is this Harlem 77711?
Hello, fellas. This is Duke Ellington.
Get it. Pause. Let's get sweet and hot.
In the opinion of hot music critics, Count Basie has one of the best dance orchestras in the country.
King of the clarinet, Artie Shaw, and his orchestra making dance history in the Blue Room of the Hotel Lincoln in New York City.
Every Thursday from 10 till noon, join me, your host, Charles Burnham, for Sweet and Hot, a celebration of the 78 RPM record, the three-minute masterpiece in the golden age of North American songwriting. Hot jazz, swing, and popular music from the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. That's every Thursday from 10 till noon here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Enjoy that blue bottle?
That's a swell record. I must get it. What's his number?
Sexy and Van City Radio may contain adult content. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to Sexy and Van City Radio on 101.9 FM, CITR. Good evening. Welcome to Sexy in Van City Radio 101.9 FM on CITR. Or maybe you're one of our podcast listeners. However you've decided to spend this hour with us, we are very, 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 very glad to have you. My guest tonight is a very special man who is calling from the States. So I'm very, very excited to have him on, and we are going to be talking about Fibroid Awareness Week, which is pretty exciting in the States, and I think it's really important to spread the message all the way through Canada. So regardless whether you're listening via podcast, whether you're listening as we speak live, it's a really important thing. So, because apparently about how almost half the population of U.S. women are affected by the fibroids. And I have a special guest on tonight, Dr. Bruce McLucas, and he's the founder of the National Fibroid Treatment Center. And I'm really excited to have him on the show. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Caroline.
You're welcome. So you were just mentioning that, am I popping your cherry in terms of being on the radio?
This is our first radio event on Fibroid Awareness Week, and I'm certainly happy to speak to all the Canadians up there, and you know, there's no difference between Americans and Canadians. I mean, this is a disease that affects about 40% of women wherever you are.
40%, that's incredible. So why don't we start with just telling our listeners a little bit about what are fibroids?
A good question. Well, fibroids are growths within the uterus, Caroline. They're benign tumors, and don't be confused, because benign tumors can cause some really big problems. Normally, if you hold your fist up, that's the size of the normal uterus, and fibroids are growths that can make the uterus as big as a full-term pregnancy uterus.
Wow.
Yeah, and common symptoms that women will have is heavy bleeding or pressure on the bowel or bladder. It's pretty disabling.
Yeah, you mentioned on your website, actually, in regards to it be really, really challenging, especially taking a plane or having to sit for long periods of time.
Well, that's for sure. The website you're talking about, I think, is fibroids.com. And almost everything that we're going to talk about, your listeners can find on the website. But I've had a number of airline pilots who tell me that, you know, don't complain about the seats in the back of the plane. Imagine what it's like to be strapped into a pilot seat and have to get up and visit the ladies' room on a pretty regular basis. That gets pretty old on a Air Canada flight from Toronto to London. Well, I guess nobody's flying to London these days. Maybe they are. I don't know.
It's hard to say. But, no, it's true. It would be very uncomfortable. What do you think causes fibroids?
Carolyn, we don't know exactly what causes fibroids. We know that they are sensitive to estrogen.
Mm-hmm.
There's two times in a woman's life when there's a big surge of estrogen. One is when a woman's pregnant. The other is, ironically, as a woman gets closer to the menopause, there's a lot more estrogen, unopposed estrogen in the system. So typically, the average age of a woman is somebody in their 40s,
mm-hmm.
affected with this disease. But we've had women in their 70s, as well as our youngest patient is 18. So, you know,
18 years old.
Yeah.
Wow. Is it difficult to diagnose, like if they weren't coming to the clinic, for example?
The symptoms of fibroids are fairly typical symptoms that a lot of women complain about,
mm-hmm.
pain, either with intercourse or their menstrual periods, or just general pressure and pain. So, you know, sometimes, like all of us, we can say, well, it's going to go away, but they're usually picked up on a examination with a healthcare provider. Pelvic examination will usually give it away.
Okay. So I was just wondering if somebody was trying to diagnose, and I don't know if you get this with there's just so much information on the web, in the internet these days, that sometimes perhaps people try and self-diagnose themselves before you see them, if that ever happens, where they might mix up cysts or endometriosis or anything, possibly.
Well, that's a common problem. About 5% of the people who come into our office down at UCLA in California. We don't have a very good hockey team, so you probably never heard of UCLA.
I've heard about it for acting, though, and things like that.
But way to go with that Olympic in the hockey tournament. Good for you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, yeah. Self-diagnosis doesn't work for almost any problem, but, you know, most of our patients are pretty well informed, Caroline. They come in with a pretty good idea of what's going wrong, and most of them have been told they have to have a hysterectomy. That
mm-hmm.
means removal of the whole uterus to take care of the problem. And, you know, what we're, I guess, sort of pioneers in the United States is in bringing a new treatment called fibroid embolization to these women to allow them to keep their uterus and avoid surgery. Yeah, it's pretty exciting.
Which I think is really great, because I know I was checking a couple Canadian websites as well, and I couldn't find that on there. So I thought that was really exciting. So tell us a little bit more about that process.
Well, fibroid embolization is not a surgery. It's a procedure where we gain access to the endovascular system, went to the arterial system, and it's a very elegant way of treating fibroids. The procedure was first developed by a colleague of mine in Paris named Jacques Ravina, and the concept is just, like all good ideas, pretty simple. You think about a fire. If you throw a blanket on a fire, there's no oxygen, and in the body, the oxygen to every bit of our tissue comes through the arterial blood supply in the red blood cells. So if we block that blood supply, eventually the fibroids will have no blood supply, and they will shrink. They'll shrink up to 50%.
Wow. That's incredible. How far along would you I know obviously it would depend on case per case, but for somebody to take it, like in terms of actually getting the procedure done, because I know there's other alternatives as well, like in terms of obviously not hysterectomy, but I do know that there's some doctors that will recommend birth control, for example, and what are your thoughts on that?
Hormones can sometimes slow down the growth of fibroids,
mm-hmm.
but they very seldom make them get smaller. There are medications that can work for a short period of time, but that's all they do. They're sort of like a Band-Aid. They will slow down the growth, but they won't
actually affect the problem.
Won't affect the problem, and something usually has to be done. Now, there's another procedure that can be done surgically. It's called a myomectomy.
I was going to ask what that was.
Yeah, well, that's myomas is what we doctors call fibroids, but it will just, I mean, we could call it a fibroidectomy, but yeah. That's to usually
fibroid.
cut into the uterus and remove the fibroids and sew it back up.
Hmm.
It's not a bad operation, but it has a lot of disadvantages. It's a operation where you usually lose a fair amount of blood.
Mm-hmm.
On top of that, the big disadvantage is that the fibroids tend to recur. I mean, there's little fibroids that are maybe the size of your fingernail
mm-hmm.
that can grow up to the size of a watermelon. So even though your doctor may do a good job, they will come back. And that's one of the huge advantages of fibroid embolization is that there's no recurrence.
That's incredible. How long has embolization been around?
Well, it was started in France in the late 80s. We brought it to the United States in 1994. And probably worldwide, there's been probably about 1 million women who've had this procedure. It's been very successful. And
mm-hmm.
some of your listeners out there who may be in reproductive age and still want to have a family should be happy to know that many of our patients have been able to have full-term pregnancies after an embolization.
That's fantastic. How long does embolization take? Like, is it a series kind of like laser where you're getting things like every couple months, or is it just a one-time, hopefully solves things in terms of everything?
Well, fibroid embolization works 90% of the time, and it is a one-time procedure.
One-time.
I tell patients to think about how they felt 4 years ago, and after we shrink those fibroids 50%,
mm-hmm.
They're going to be, that's what they're going to be feeling like for the rest of their life. So it's a one-time procedure. It's not one that you have to, like your dermatologist, have to go back time after time for.
Mm-hmm. In regards to someone who has fibroids, how long, say they come into the clinic, you've assessed them, and they want to get the treatment. And I'm just curious because in Canada, sometimes we have to wait a really, really long time because ours is more of a public system as opposed to private. So are people able to get in fairly quickly, or how does that work in the States?
Well, I think it depends a little bit upon, if you ask me a year from now,
mm-hmm.
our healthcare system may be closer to the Canadian system. And
where ours might be going a little bit closer to the American.
Yeah, who knows? But usually, you should know that I think in your country, although I'm not an expert on the Canadian mm-hmm. health system, embolization is available in Canada. It's certainly... is available almost every hospital in the United States at this point. So, once you find out if you're really a candidate for it, and we're always happy to take a look at somebody's health history if they want to go to fibroids.com and just click on the Contact Us. We're able to answer a lot of those questions just by looking at some kind of an imaging study and tell you what your chances are.
That's fantastic. A lot of times, sometimes in this country, we do have to wait a little while. It's based on need sometimes and what's a higher priority in terms of for services sometimes. So it can be a little bit challenging.
Well, tomorrow we're going to be doing an embolization on a patient from Nigeria and a patient from the Maritime Provinces in Canada.
Mm.
So, yeah, there you go. I mean, a lot of people seek us out for that.
Well, I think it's important, and it's good to let our Canadian listeners out there know that they can go down to UCLA and check things out, which I think is great.
Well, we're always happy to have our Canadian visitors come on down.
Well, thank you very much. The other question I was going to ask in regards to that is, you mentioned one of the really key symptoms was heavy bleeding during menstrual time, but as well as that, pain during intercourse. And in regards to that, I imagine in terms of, because I know when I've got my cycle, for example, and I'm in cramps and stuff like that, sometimes I'm not in the mood, and with that, sometimes if I'm not in the mood for a couple days, it affects my self-esteem a little bit and things like that. And so for a woman who perhaps has had fibroids for a while, what are some tips that you might advise in terms of just trying to keep self-esteem up and spirits up in terms of that first of all, and then second, I'm going to ask you in regards to what we can do in terms of strengthening relationships with someone who has fibroids.
You know, one of my patients said it pretty well. She said it's like porcupine sex. Do you have porcupines up there?
I just felt everything just clench right up, and yes, we do have porcupines, and I can't imagine having that.
You know, the closer you get to wanting to have sex, I mean, the more it hurts, and the less you're going to want to do it. I mean, the uterus does contract when a woman has an orgasm.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can imagine, you know, contracting with something the size of a grapefruit or a... you have grapefruits up there, too, don't you?
We do have grapefruits. We have a lot of things in Canada, actually.
Yeah, good, okay. So... You know, that won't be very pleasant as well. So,
no.
You know, I think the key is to find out soon enough whether the fibroids are really the problem, and then to you know, have resolve, as women are great to do, and you know, switch that problem around.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So basically being more proactive, basically finding out if that possibly could be an option. What other type of options could it be if it wasn't fibroids, besides we mentioned endometriosis, possibly cysts, in that 5% that come in, that it's not necessarily fibroids once you've assessed them. Are there any other things that, besides psychological as well, that we might want to add to the list of reasons that it may be painful?
Well, you've mentioned endometriosis, and
mm-hmm.
we can't assume that all your listeners understand what that is.
So we should tell them a little bit, and I'd love that.
Sure, thanks. it's the lining of the uterus is called the endometrium, and we don't know exactly why, but in some women, it goes out through the fallopian tubes, where that lining implants on the fallopian tubes or the ovaries,
mm-hmm.
and it causes scar tissue. So you can have very painful intercourse. You can have painful menstruation, and just pain with exercise. I mean, you can have painful bowel movements, urination. Ouch, I'm hurting just talking about it. Yeah. That typically is a disease that is going to take care of showing itself earlier on in life than fibroids. I mean, that's a disease we see in a lot of the Gen X's, a lot of the 20-year-olds. Again, a pelvic exam will be able to tell a woman if there's if the problem is in the uterus or there's something else. Now, there's also pelvic infections, and if you had an infection, that could cause adhesions too, and that could cause pain. So, just don't assume that everything is because of fibroid, sure.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask, in regards to, you said almost up to almost 50% of women in the States, especially between 40 to 50, are affected by the disease in terms of fibroids. What I was going to ask in regards to that is, why do you think that is? Do you think it's possible since the onset of a social acceptance in terms of using the birth control pill, which has been going on for a while and for a very long time, at least I think of like the swinging 60s and stuff like that, and just think in terms of where we've been a little bit more open, but also having hormones in our body in terms of just trying to balance out so we can't get pregnant. Do you think perhaps that might have some reason to do with why there's an increase in women with fibroids?
Oh, I'm beginning to feel like Austin Powers. You know, as long as we can have unprotected sex, everything's fine. And
that's what condoms are for, my darling.
The
safety.
The birth control pill probably doesn't have a big effect on the presence of fibroids. I mean, a lot of my patients will say, "Well, is it inherited in the family? I mean, my mother had fibroids, and does that mean I will?" It's an unusual family in any country where there isn't a woman, an aunt, a mother, a grandmother, a sister, who hasn't had surgery because of fibroids. I mean, it is a public health question. When you've got something that affects 40% of women, the question really isn't why me. The question is, how come everybody doesn't get fibroids? And we don't know that. But you know, my cholesterol is elevated, and I can do a lot to try and change it and not eat as much of that good Canadian beef. But I still will have a high cholesterol, so I probably have to, and I probably will for the rest of my life, have to take medication to bring it down.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that the birth control pill had anything to do with the incidence of fibroids. It's really been there for
a long time.
Your mother's and your grandmother's generation. The only difference is that, you know, fibroid embolization is it's not your mother's cure. It was never there when she was faced with this problem.
Hysterectomy time.
That's it.
I'm wondering if it has increased to 40%, and I should ask if that is the case, and if that's possible because women talk about this stuff more.
Well, gee, that's a good question. I don't think talking about, that's oral sex, isn't it? Talking about sex?
Well, you're not supposed to talk when you have your mouth full.
I don't think that...
unless you're humming.
I don't think that the incidence of fibroids has really changed a lot in the last generation. I do think that with the internet that women are certainly more aware of treatment options for this problem, Caroline. I you know, back in the 90s, we've been doing the embolization down in California for about, 16 years now. And
wow.
Typically, the typical patient was somebody who was told by her physician that she had to have a hysterectomy. And then found us on the internet, and you know, it's out there. It's an alternative that that women have sought and really bought for themselves. I mean, it's a wonderful new treatment.
I think it's fantastic, and by having fibroid awareness, I think it's great too, because hopefully it's educating the men out there as well. So if they do have a partner that, and I was going to ask this, would they possibly, depending on the size of the fibroid, possibly be able to feel it during intercourse?
If a fibroid is
like a 5-month-old baby.
Yeah, that's right up at your belly button. So I mean, that one would be pretty hard. It's like an advanced slope, a double diamond slope at Whistler. I mean, if you look at the abdomen, it's a pretty it's pretty obvious at that point. And you know, as far as intercourse goes, when you're trying to have a penis pushing against a can we say that in Canada?
You can totally say penis. You can say fuck. It's after 10 o'clock.
Oh, my God. Oh, I've got to move.
We are a pretty liberal city.
Okay. Well, all right then. I think you can assume that if the penis is pushing against a fibroid that's down in the vagina, and it doesn't make it pleasant either for either partner.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you're hetero or homosexual, it's got to be a difficult thing to have intercourse, yeah.
Mm-hmm. In regards to that, what about, what can guys do if they do think that their partner has possibly fibroids? Like, how to broach that conversation? Because I think it's a delicate one sometimes, where it's like, honey, you got a lump in your breast in terms of breast cancer, where it can make some women uncomfortable, just because sometimes we don't want to actually acknowledge there's issues.
You know, I just wish that all of us guys were better listeners. It's not us who bring up the subject, but if you give your partner a chance, and it's, you know, relationships are more than just sex, that these topics will come up, and I think women again are much more aware of their health and are just maybe looking for a validation that it's a good idea to look into what's going on.
Now that makes perfect sense. I am hoping though with the Awareness Week that more guys are more aware. What is the demographic in terms of the campaign? Because you're mentioning in terms of 40 to 50-year-old, women tend to be the majority of women who are affected, even though it does affect as young as 18 and even women in their 70s. But so I was just curious in terms of how are you going about the campaign. I love how you've got the live chat on the site, which is great. And you're mentioning they could actually go onto the website as well to find out some more information.
Yeah, we do. We do have it, fibroids.com. We do have a live chat. We're not active on the live chat. I guess I'm the live chat right now because we closed down about 6 o'clock your time.
Okay.
But we are, you know, open from 8 until 6 on the same time zone.
Mm-hmm.
It's always a and I'm always available to take calls once somebody said they'd like to speak to me a little bit more down at in Los Angeles. So we try and answer all those calls,
which I think is so great that you're keeping the lines of communication so open.
Well, it's always a challenge, especially we've had a few people come in. And try and talk to us from China. And, boy, that's a different time zone. Yeah.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
That's very close to it, because I think we're an hour different, so.
You know, Carolyn, you're talking about some of the different age groups, and there is this urban myth that fibroids will go away after the menopause, you know, and that probably, that myth got started because very few women with fibroids had their uterus in the menopause. Most of them were people who had had a hysterectomy.
Mm-hmm.
So we do find that there's a material that's secreted by fat cells that mimics estrogen, and the fibroids do continue to grow in the menopause. And if women are taking any estrogen replacement, that may be something that can cause the fibroids to grow as well.
That makes perfect sense. One of the things I was curious about is there certain positions in terms of sexually that don't press so much on the abdomen wall? Because I'm imagining in terms of having sex, in terms of trying to make it a little bit less painful. And any thoughts on that?
Well, I guess doggy style would be better.
Doggy style is always good.
Yeah, yeah, it would probably be better. But there's a certain point where... you know, depending on the size of the uterus, that is just, you know, it becomes sort of like having sex when you're pregnant. You've got to, it's not going to be easy to do it at any point.
That makes sense. But definitely trying different positions and being open about it. Because I imagine with a partner, especially when it's painful, because I personally believe that I think sex is one of the ways of communication in a lot of things. So if that falls apart because one partner is in a lot of pain, I think it affects the rest of the relationship.
Yeah, I agree.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. It is, as you said, it's a form of communication. It's an intimate form of communication.
But very intimate.
It's not going to be a monologue, if you will. It's got to be something that's shared between two people.
I may have to keep quoting on you on that. Sex is not a monologue; it's a dialogue.
Well, sometimes it's a monologue, but not, you know, not if it's two people involved.
Yeah, I like to think of monologues still as dialogues. It makes it more entertaining and a lot more fun. The other thing I was going to ask is in regards to fibroid awareness, for how has everything evolved just in terms of from the time you've been involved? Because you had mentioned, I believe you said that you've been doing the embolization for about 16 years?
Yes, we have. We we brought this procedure over from France back in 1994, and I had actually studied with Professor Ravina in France. It's a wonderful story about how it got started. Maybe I can share it with
you. I would love to hear that. I like beginnings.
Yeah, this was beginnings and middles and all that.
Yes, it's good to have all. It's nice to start at the beginning.
Professor Ravina was working in a hospital, and in France, just like in Canada, things are sort of centralized in healthcare. And in his hospital, he got a lot of women who were scheduled to have hysterectomies, but they were so anemic that they couldn't undergo surgery. So the referring doctor would send them to Professor Ravina's hospital to stop the bleeding. And we knew, even back in the 70s, that embolization would stop heavy bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would do the procedure on these patients, and then he'd call the doctor 6 months later and say, well, how did the surgery go? And the doctor would say, well, not only did it stop the bleeding, but now they don't have any pain. So what Professor Ravinner was able to realize was that that not only did it stop the bleeding, but it shrank the fibroids. And you know, I'm sure at some point he'll get a Nobel Prize for that.
Which I think is fantastic. How did you yourself get involved?
I've always been interested in less invasive therapy for problems that were what we would call surgical problems. One example of that is completely out of the field we're talking about was a while ago, people realized that stomach ulcers it could be solved by a different form of antibiotic therapy, and you could avoid all the surgeries that were done for stomach ulcers. So it was a real breakthrough there. And this particular procedure allows a woman not to undergo a big scar in the abdomen.
Mm-hmm.
One of the other things that's nice about fibroid embolization is the recovery time. I mean, it's an outpatient procedure. People will go home either that day or possibly the next morning.
And you said it doesn't take very long.
No, it doesn't. Mm-hmm. It takes about 20 minutes. And it's also done under what we call sedation. Now, your listeners don't have to be doctors to know that it's a lot more dangerous to undergo a general anesthetic than it mm-hmm. is sedation. They're back at work usually within 5 days compared to that 6 weeks recovery time that major surgery takes.
Which is incredible.
Well, it's a good beginning.
It's a really good beginning. When were you first exposed to it yourself, this procedure?
Oh, I can remember that very well. It's a wonderful story.
I'd love to hear it.
I had a patient back at UCLA who was having very heavy bleeding. It was on Thanksgiving Day in 1994. Do you have Thanksgiving up there?
We do have Thanksgiving, although ours is in October, usually the second week in October.
See, there we are. We're trying to catch up with the Canadians there. Well, we're a month late. But bleeding, this patient was bleeding very heavily, and she would not have been a candidate for a myomectomy, a surgery to remove the fibroids. And
mm-hmm.
it was either going to be, we were just giving her lots of units of blood, and I called in my colleague, Scott Goodwin, who was working with me back then in the 1994, and performed the first one in the United States and stopped the bleeding. And the story has a wonderful happy ending that 2 years later, the patient had a beautiful little baby girl who's now, I guess, about 14. And we were able to save the uterus, and now she has a teenager. I don't know whether that's a good thing or not.
It's probably a little bit of both, a little bit of joy.
Yeah.
No, I think that's fantastic. What are some, I was going to ask in regards to the awareness, how long has that been going on in the States, or is this the first year it's happened?
Well, this is the first year that we've put aside a week.
Mm-hmm.
For people to think about fibroids, and the response has been wonderful. We've had lots of links to other websites, and I think we'll see a lot more happening. I can't imagine a fibroid parade ever, but I think we'll see a lot more discussions and people just, as the word is, awareness, of people getting more aware and more in tune with the problem that they may not have known was the fibroid. As you said, it could be a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm. Is there any support groups in terms of for couples or for women who have fibroids?
The answer is yes, and there's a lot of chat groups on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of blogs about fibroids. I mean, gee whiz, if you, you know...
If you Google
the fibroids, there you go. You'll probably find, you know, fibroid support groups. There's probably plenty up there in
Canada.
BC, yes.
What about in the States?
Yeah, plenty down here, too. There's plenty of fibroids to go around.
The other thing I was going to ask is if there was one in terms of for partners. I know, for example, here for cervical cancer, once a year, one of the cancer clinics actually does a... They do couple counseling, I believe, all through the year, just in regards to how it can affect. But as well as that, I was just wondering if there's anything that was similar to that for people with fibroids. Because I think even though it affects the woman, it affects both people.
Most of my patients who come in with their partners. And, you know, I have to say tip of the hat to the guys for coming along on that. It's... you know, better or for worse, as they say, and most of the men have been very supportive. A lot of the times, it's been the techie in the couple, and that sometimes that's the man who's found the information about fibroid embolization and brought the their partner in to learn about this option.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. I think that's so important, just to work together, and whichever person is finding out the information, just passing it on, so then that way it can heal everything. Is there anything afterwards in regards to just, because you said it's non-invasive, sometimes for side effects, it seems pretty minimal, but just like there's sometimes a little bit of nausea, but there's not, doesn't sound like there's too much, sometimes fever, but... I just wanted to double check if there's anything on an emotional level that you found with some of the patients, perhaps.
Well, my grandpa used to say, if it sounds too good to be true, it is. So I don't want to tell your listeners that there's no side effects to fibroid embolization. Mm. But if you look at the, in medicine, we call it the morbidity. Things that can go wrong after a major surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Major surgeries, myomectomy or hysterectomy, can be as high as 40% of the time you can have something from an infection, a blood clot. Some are minor, some are serious.
Mm-hmm.
The risks of fibroid embolization are very small. And having said that, you touched on, yes, there is a little bit of pain. We always used to say discomfort, but let's call it pain. But it's very short-lived, and if a patient has never had a surgery, she might feel like, oh, gee, that was fairly significant. But compared to a woman who's had a major abdominal surgery, either a C-section, a cesarean section, or a myomectomy, it's much less than that.
Mm-hmm.
So the pain isn't so bad. There's a... statistical small risk of premature menopause. Now, in women in our clinic under the age of 40, I've never seen it.
Okay.
Between 40 and 45, it's 1-2%. Over the age of 45, it goes up.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the things that you might have to
be aware of.
It's the same risk could happen with myomectomy, that fibroid surgery that is a major surgery. So if the fibroid is on a stalk, if you think about a golf ball on a tee, and it's inside the uterus, it's possible that that fibroid might pass out through the cervix. It's not a big deal. It's just a dilation and curettage to get it out. But that can happen occasionally too.
Wow. Does it actually change the fact or fiction? Does it actually change the shape of the uterus for good?
Let's see. Does embolization change, or does fibroids change? Well, fibroids, yeah, they distort. To think about the again, that you hold up your fist, that's the size of the uterus.
Mm-hmm.
And if that fist becomes the size of a watermelon, it's probably because of the multiple fibroids that are getting it expanded and making it bigger.
Mm-hmm. And afterwards?
It will be, it'll be half the size of what it was.
Okay.
It'll probably never go back to completely normal. For a lot of women in their 40s, that's really not important. It's the relief of symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
It's getting rid of the pain, the pressure. A lot of our patients have pain going down either leg or back pain. Those symptoms just tend to go away pretty quick.
Which sounds fantastic. So I can understand that being a relief. In regards to orgasm for women who perhaps had, would somebody still be able to have a clitoral orgasm during, if they had fibroids?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
The clitoris is pretty unaffected by the presence of the fibroids. In general, I would say almost all of our patients, there's a few exceptions, have reported that their life in general, including their sex life, has gotten a lot better after embolization.
Mm-hmm. Which makes sense, because just in general feeling more well and just in general feeling good. Because I honestly believe if somebody feels good, you can do anything, and it just affects every aspect of our lives.
Well, I can't disagree with that. If you're faced with a chronic illness, it's pretty hard to relax and enjoy intercourse, and fibroids are one of those diseases that tends to be a chronic illness.
Mm-hmm. No, it definitely sounds like that. In terms of our listeners out there who may not be familiar with a hysterectomy, because it almost sounds like, I know it comes from the word hysterical originally, but I was just curious. They used to recommend that for a lot of things. I've actually got a cousin who actually had a hysterectomy because they were fearful in terms of ovarian cancer at one point, where they actually used to be able to test to see if genetically you might possibly be a candidate for it. So what other reasons besides fibroids would somebody get a hysterectomy present day that you think that they'd absolutely have to?
In the United States, Carolyn, mm-hmm. about 600,000 hysterectomies are done every year.
600,000?
Yeah, lots of fibroids. But of those hysterectomies, at least 40% are caused by fibroids. So you're looking at more than 250,000 procedures that probably could be avoided
by
fibroid embolization.
Wow.
Again, I don't want to put fear in front of
your listeners.
But you should have somebody make sure that that bleeding is not because of a cancer, we can't assume that everything that happens that causes the symptoms similar to fibroids is caused by fibroids. So it's real important to see your health practitioner and certainly get that pap smear. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to ask in regards to every year for listeners out there, you should make a pact with yourself to visit your doctor and have a full physical whenever it's your birthday.
That's a good idea. Sure.
So it's your birthday present to yourself, and just keeping track of things. In regards to fibroids, sometimes what I recommend for just in general health is to actually keep a journal. And do you recommend for your patients to be keeping a journal beforehand just so they can really notice the difference, like the before, the after, the during, like the beginning, middle, and end?
That's a great idea. Keep track of your menstrual periods. A lot of our patients will come in and I'll say, well, what's bothering you? And their answer is, well, I have a lot of pain with intercourse or exercise. And I'll ask about their periods. And I'll say, oh, my periods are pretty normal. And then I'll get a blood count. And it'll come back from the lab. And I'll say, well, gee whiz, you shouldn't be walking around. You're so anemic it's not an acute blood loss. I mean, it's not like you're bleeding from a cut,
mm-hmm.
but your body can get used to being anemic, and it you know, over a period of time, that can cause pretty severe symptoms. I mean, pain, fatigue, and not wanting to get up in the morning. You may not be depressed. You might just be anemic.
Hmm. What are the symptoms of anemia for those people out there who aren't familiar?
Weakness, dizziness, general malaise, the French would say.
I like that, malaise. I was going to say listless.
Listless, yeah, yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, sounds like Washington these days. Maybe they all have fibroids down there. We don't know about them.
They possibly could have fibroids. That'd be very, very interesting. So, I was going to ask in regards to fibroids, have you ever seen it, and is it possible for someone who is transgendered from male to female?
Okay.
Sorry, it was just a question I thought of now, so I thought I'd ask.
I haven't seen. I have a Buddhist friend, and I'll say, "Have you ever been to some part of the world? Have you ever been to Vancouver?" And he'll say, "Not yet," because he's got so many lives yet to live that he'll have plenty of time to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I think most of the transgender folks just will not have a uterus.
Okay.
So, whereas it's possible for a woman to have a fibroid that sort of migrates from the, it's not common, but it can migrate from the uterus to the bladder or to other parts of the female reproductive system. I just haven't seen it in transgenders from male to female. No, not yet.
Okay.
As my Buddhist friend would say.
What about from female to male? And the reason why I was thinking of that is about a year and a half ago, there was that case where a female to male, where she actually had a baby, which People magazine was dubbing her as the, or him, as the first man who ever gave birth. So I was just curious. But I guess if somebody has a uterus, depending. Possibly.
Yeah, I mean, if whatever the cosmetic surgery that changed the outside of the genitalia didn't take care of the uterus. If the uterus is still there, mm-hmm. I mean, you still have that 40% chance of having a fibroid. Now, if you're taking a fair amount of testosterone, maybe that would keep the fibroids from growing because it's an opposite of estrogen. But I'm sure that, you know, they'll be somebody coming in out here having a fibroid embolization who's a transgender female to male.
Okay, that makes, I could see that actually, depending on the surgery. What's next in regards to after this week is over? And I know you started everything, I believe it was over a week ago? Because it was.
Yeah, we're
so you're into the
we're
week
sort
two.
Of at the tail end of. We're here for the closing ceremonies of the Fibroid Olympics, and that was a wonderful Olympics, by the way. Congratulations to you.
Oh, thank you very much. It was pretty exciting, and it was great to have everybody in Vancouver. And now we're living through Stanley Cup.
So. Well, there's more. There's always.
There's always more, but the Olympics was pretty awesome.
And that's. I guess it's sort of like Mother's Day. You have that in Canada too, don't you?
We do.
Yeah, and you know, I just I tell folks that you know, Mother's Day, it's great to have it the other 364 days of the year too, and just you know, just tell your mom not just that you love her, but why? What is it she does that, you know, that you love about her? So there's not much to love about fibroids, but there's certainly a chance that you'll remember this week and take it with you when there's a problem coming up in the next week or the week after that.
Mm-hmm. In a perfect world, like just say you clicked your heels three times like Dorothy did and could have whatever wish you wanted in regards to this week, what would you like to see it like 10 years from now if you're on my show and I asked you how has this evolved in the last 10 years? What would you like to see this Fibroid Awareness Week turn evolve into?
Oh, I would love it if there were a pill that would just shrink fibroids or you know, 40% of the population. What about if if there was a vaccine that could keep people from having this terrible problem, and even though it's not a cancer, it could just keep the problem from surfacing in the first place. I don't know if that's 10 years from now, but I personally don't think that that this is going to be the last treatment, but it's certainly the best treatment we have right now.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that would be awesome. And I think it's good that you're promoting it, because I think it's so important, because I wasn't aware of it before I got the email about it. So I'm really excited to be able to let our listeners know about it, too, because I think it's really important. In regards to what's next for you personally after this?
Oh, I'm going to bed.
Sorry, I didn't mean my immediate.
the
next little bit.
We start pretty early. I don't know what time they start surgery in Canada, but we start around six in the morning. So,
wow.
I'll have to have a good, strong cup of coffee in the morning after this.
I owe you a Starbucks if you come up to Vancouver.
Okay, good. Or you? Well, whatever brand we get.
Do you have Starbucks? Yeah. You have Starbucks in the States. It's from Seattle, right?
But. I think that I am a gynecologist, and I'm one of the only gynecologists that I know of in this country that does this procedure. A lot of the doctors who do it in Canada are interventional radiologists, so I think probably there's going to be the next 10 years a big surge in teaching my fellow gynecologists how to do the procedure. So that's probably where you'll find me in 10 years.
I think that'd be fantastic, and hopefully we'll see less and less hysterectomies if they don't need to be done.
Oh, I think that would be wonderful. Wouldn't that be great?
I think that'd be really, really great. It actually makes me shudder. When I was, I think, 8 years old, I actually got my cycle quite early. I remember sitting there and my mother laughing with my family doctor because I actually asked for a hysterectomy at 8 and then again at 11 because I didn't want to ever deal with pain ever again. So.
Wow.
That was back in the days.
Well, hopefully he said no. No, not yet, yeah.
Yeah, he told me I could come back and see him when I was 21.
Yeah.
Which by then, the birth control pill took care of a lot of that, so.
Great. It's a great story.
Well, I've been really glad to have you on the show. So let's just let our listeners know a few resources. So you were mentioning that there's been live chat every day. So if people may not be quite ready to call in yet, but would like to find out some more information, what time is the live chat going on constantly? And is there any seminars or anything that are going on the sites?
Yeah, thanks for asking. We do a webinar about twice a month. And your listeners can go to fibroids.com, and there should be a link right there for them to sign up, and they can ask questions, and I can attempt to answer most of those questions. And the ones we don't get in the air, we try and respond to each one of them later on.
Mm-hmm.
It is basically 9 a.m. to 6 p.m., the same time zone that you're on.
Mm-hmm.
They can go to fibroids.com and just click on the live chat, and there should be one of our friendly staff there to talk to them.
I think that sounds fantastic. And within Canada as well, what else would you recommend in terms of resources? Because I think it's great that it's online, because then that way everybody can take a look. Are there any books or anything that you'd recommend for people to take a look at, just to get some more information as well?
Well, there's a lot of books that have been written about fibroids, but
something that's recent, because I know with the website it's a lot easier to update that when as the research keeps changing and evolving.
Yeah, and that's it, really. I mean, you just have to. We try, and on our website at fibroids.com, we have a little section on current medical articles as well as consumer articles.
Mm.
So, yeah, it keeps changing, and there's a lot of stuff being written every day.
which I think is great. And for our social media people out there, do you have a Facebook page or a Twitter page that they can follow?
I think so.
Okay, I'll check with...
I think so. My kids tell me I do.
So. It's a good way to get the word out there, too. I think it's great what you're doing. Thank you so much.
Well, until 10 years from now or sooner, it's been great chatting with you.
Well, likewise, and I look forward to having you on the show again.
So I hope so.
That'd be great.
Thanks, Caroline.
You're welcome. Well, up next is Hans von Klaus's Misery Hour. He is a very, very sexy man to be miserable with, and he will be guiding you into the wee hours with his ambient music and his super hot, sexy voice.